episode of Progress, Potential, and Possibilities, discussions with fascinating people designing a better tomorrow for all of us. I'm your host, Ira Pastor. Welcome, everybody, again to another episode of our show, bringing you another really fascinating guest today who is helping to create a better tomorrow in this world for all of us and many other species as well. We have the honor today of being joined by Ben Novak, who is lead scientist at Revive and Restore, which is a California-based nonprofit organization that works to bring biotechnology to the area of conservation biology, ultimately with a mission of enhancing biodiversity through the use of genetic rescue of both endangered and extinct animals. Ben collaboratively pioneers new tools for genetic rescue and so-called de-extinction, helps shape the genetic rescue efforts of the organization, and leads its flagship project known as the Great Passenger Pigeon Comeback, working with various collaborators and partners to restore the ecology of the passenger pigeon in the eastern northern American forests. Ben's mission in leading this project is ultimately to set the standard for de-extinction protocols and considerations in both the lab and the field. He had a 2018 review article entitled De-Extinction, which is in the journal Genes, helping to define this new term. And then in December 2019, in the Routledge Handbook of Animal Ethics, more recently defined sort of the whole area of building ethical de-extinction programs, considerations of animal welfare for genetic rescue, which was the name of the publication. Ben's work at Revive and Restore also includes extensive education and outreach, the convening of various workshops, and also helping to develop their avian and black-footed ferret genetic rescue programs, as well as he's involved in Revive and Restore's Catalyst Science Fund. Ben graduated from Montana State University, studying both ecology and evolution. Later, he trained in paleogenomics at McMaster University, Ancient DNA Center in Ontario. He did his master's thesis in oncology and evolutionary biology at UC Santa Cruz, where this formed the foundational science work for de-extinction. And Ben has also worked at the Australian Animal Health Laboratory, Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organization, CSIRO, to advance genetic engineering protocols for the pigeon work. A lot of really interesting things to discuss today. Ben Novak, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Thanks for having me today.
Yeah, I'm really excited about this one because this is a fascinating topic. You know, a lot of things that we're going to be talking about, but you know, I would love to start off as we typically do, just by handing our guests the floor for a little bit to talk a little bit more about themselves. If you can sort of take us back a little bit, sort of everything, Ben, from where you grew up to how you got interested in ecology and study of evolution and ultimately in this fascinating role you're currently in. I think that'd be a great way to lay the groundwork for what we'll be talking about.
Well, yeah, all right. Well, you've already given my entire online biography, which, you know, after hearing it out loud, I think I'm going to need to edit that down and streamline it. I was born and raised in Western North Dakota, near Theodore Roosevelt National Park.
Sure.
And you know, the things I'm doing in my life now were actually heavily shaped by where I was from, in the fact that Theodore Roosevelt National Park is a beautiful and rugged landscape that named after Theodore Roosevelt because he had a couple different ranches in that area. And in the late 1800s, he moved out to that area, one for his health, but also to hunt the American bison. And when he got there, there were hardly any bison left. Mm-hmm. And that fact, as well as the kind of, as I said, rugged beauty of that place, really shaped him into the conservationist he became. In his copious amounts of writing, you see that it's when he moved there that he started to think differently about land and posterity and heritage of the conservation movement. And so, you know, it's a very special place. I feel like it's the Mecca for anyone interested in conservation to go and see where the real power and politics behind conservation comes from. So what's also unique about that landscape for me growing up there is, even though it's a small park, I would go there and I was, you know, you're guaranteed to see some bison in the park now today. You can most likely catch some elk, especially if you go to the Medora Musical. They tend to hang out by there almost as if they're trained for the tourists. And it's pretty rare. You have to be there quite a few times to spot the bighorn sheep, but they are there. And those are all three incredible species that were extinct in the area for decades before conservationists decided to bring them back into that ecosystem. So I grew up, you know, exposed to the idea of bringing back things that had gone extinct. Mm-hmm. And of course, those things, bighorn sheep and bison and elk, they all lived and survived somewhere else. So it wasn't so difficult to go and take some elk from the Western Rockies and bring them back into Theodore Roosevelt National Park. But it is, in an essence, the exact same thing that we're proposing with species like the passenger pigeon or the heath hen at Revive and Restore. And it was when I was about 13, between 13 and 14 years old, that I decided this is exactly what I wanted to do with my life. And it became incredibly fascinated with extinct species. From a childhood standpoint, I was obsessed with dinosaurs, as most are. My 3-year-old boys right now are obsessed with dinosaurs, and that obsession kind of gave way to birds, and when I discovered recently extinct species like the dodo and the passenger pigeon, I mean, it just kind of united all these passions from my entire life, that are, you know, to tell the truth, in a sense, very, very sad passions to have. It's very somewhat depressing to be so deeply interested in things that are no longer alive. Yet the concept to me of the fact that biotechnology might allow us to recreate these things someday, it just felt like the logical next step. And I was inspired by when I was 13, 14 years old, so that people, you know the timeline here. That was about the time when the Human Genome Project was first announcing its complete human genome, even though it's actually just become complete in the last year and a half. They were missing just tiny little bits back then.
Sure.
But the full genome had been announced. There was huge movement behind the use of those that genome. And in that time, people were starting to produce more genetically engineered lab animals for research. And people were sequencing DNA from the Tasmanian tiger, better, you know, more appropriately, the thylacine. Mm-hmm. And people had already sequenced DNA from mammoths. So the idea that we could sequence DNA from long extinct species, and we were getting better at sequencing whole genomes, and people were getting better at genetic engineering. I mean, it instilled in me that biotech would get us to this point where we could dream about making replacements for these extinct species. So yeah, I was about 13, 14, and I said, this is what I'm going to do with my life. And I tailored my education towards that. And, you know, like all of the best laid plans, nothing went according to plan, but I still ended up where I wanted to be. So
awesome.
So here I am.
Outstanding. Outstanding. Yeah. I mean, it's really fascinating. I reading about Revive and Restore and the mission of sort of merging, you know, biotech with conservation, sciences, and conservation practice. And, you know, I come out of the pharmaceutical industry. Obviously biotech, you know, for decades has had a role there. I spent some time in sort of ag, and, you know, we're great at making, you know, virus resistant papayas and frost, cold resistant fish and all sorts of interesting things, but we really haven't applied these tools fully in the area of conservation yet. I did a show about a year ago with Tom Hildebrandt over in Germany, working to, you know, save the rest of the northern white rhino. And even in that discussion, I was kind of amazed that, you know, very basic tools of in vitro, but still not using, you know, this toolkit that we have on the side here. What has sort of been the hesitancy or the slow uptake in using some of these newer tools for conservation practice? And then leading into that, of course, just give us a little background to the Revive and Restore organization and how it all got started.
Yeah, well, you know, I think the hesitancy to use biotechnologies is a complex socio-political thing where it's inextricably tied to anti-GMO sentiments. But in conservation, it's also tied to a particular history of fearing unintended consequences, which is very sad in conservation because the fear of unintended consequences actually comes more from humans interfering with nature for things like agriculture.
Yeah.
Whereas conservation has actually had a really great track record of doing good work. So, you know, it's, I think people with anti-GMO sentiments, it's, you know, sadly it's tied to anti-corporate sentiments. Mm-hmm. There's definitely a fear of you know, treating biological entities as nothing more than dollar signs, that tampering with their DNA, you know, I think it, and this is, you know, just conjecture, but for millennia, the concept of human legacy and soul was tied to the concept of blood. You know, my son carries my bloodline and my daughter is my blood, and I am the son of so-and-so or the daughter of so-and-so. And you know, that idea, you know, of making blood packs and blood brothers, it's just the idea of that our soul was somehow inside our biology, has, even before, you know, we recognized anatomy and biology, was always very intimate. And with the discovery of DNA being the actual molecule that transmitted, you know, traits from one generation to another, DNA has slowly taken on the role of the bloodline. And so tampering with it for, I think, many people is tampering with the human soul. And by extension, when we start thinking of tampering with the food we eat or the organisms we rely on and live with, it extends to those souls as well. And even for people who maybe don't have the same extension to animals and plants, it's the fact that those are things that are a part of our life. Sure. And so they will affect us, you know, once we eat them and consume them. You know, none of this is based, I think, in science. People have made up science to try and support it, which has all been debunked. But it's a cultural thing. It's not a scientific thing. And I think the problem is many scientists approach this phenomenon in trying to advocate for our work or defend our work from a scientific perspective, and it has nothing to do with science. It has everything to do with the essence of what it is to be life. And, you know, for me and my work, the reason I'm so passionate about it is that, you know, I'll say this. An interviewer once asked me, if you walked into a national park and knew that everything you saw was gene edited, like, how would that make you feel? And my response was, I would feel great knowing that the alternative was walking into a national park and having nothing left. I don't think a lot of people realize that we are at a stage in which the threats that face biodiversity are insurmountable with conventional solutions. And biotechnology is a technology that offers us a way to save species, not just in the immediate, you know, short term. These are not band-aid solutions. These are long-term viable solutions.
Yep.
And they all come from nature. That's the thing. I think a lot of people think biotechnology is a little bit similar to things like the Industrial Revolution, that these are things we've completely fabricated and invented artificially, when that's not the case. We have come to the present state of biotechnology from making discoveries in yeast and bacteria and other organisms and learning about DNA. And so far, human beings have, I don't believe, done anything that's actually completely new or invented. We have simply just been discovering what nature can offer and figuring out how nature uses its own building blocks. And we are, you know, we are in our infancy of even understanding that, but we can still do really great things to help these situations. And you know, and so that was the basic oh goodness, I lost my train of thought. But you can edit this. Sure. Anyway. you know, and so in 2012 enter Ryan Phelan and Stuart Brand. Stuart Brand, you know, one of the founders of modern environmentalism, who then split from the environmental movement when they abandoned scientific thinking, and you know, realized that there was a place for technology in helping the environment. I mean, yes, technology has been one of the main things harming the environment, but as humans, I think we should all be able to recognize technology. You know, just because a tool can be used for harm does not mean you can innovate it to be a solution at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's very similar to the fact that we use the venom from snakes to produce anti-venom.
Yeah.
When you get bitten by a snake.
Yeah.
You can literally use the same tool to create a solution.
Mm-hmm.
And that's biotechnology.
Yeah.
Stuart had been following, you know, the development of these things. His wife, Ryan Phelan, had been an entrepreneur in individualized medicine and genetic medicine, and had a long standing interest in nature as well. And they were at a meeting with a friend, George Church, who is sure. one of the fathers of modern biotechnology and DNA
yep.
technologies. And, you know, just it wasn't even casual, but in somewhat passing, George had mentioned that he believed they were at a point in technology where they could start thinking of actually recreating species. And he has had a long history and passion of wanting to recreate the woolly mammoth.
Right.
And Stuart, he has a long history of being passionate about the passenger pigeons. So he ended up writing a letter to George asking, you know, do you think we could create something like the passenger pigeon, something with that kind of classic Americana and history behind it that people might really support and could be good for nature? And George, you know, and Stuart said, you know, I could probably create a nonprofit around this. You know, he's one of the founders and presidents of the Long Now Foundation. So, I mean, he has a history of success in this area. And Ryan bringing her very entrepreneurial mindset to it. You know, I think they were just a powerhouse that created what we are today. But with that spark of a vision back then, you know, it's what launched this. Mm-hmm. And they had their first meeting about the passenger pigeon in 2012. And Beth Shapiro, who is now one of our board members, was there. And she, of course, is one of the major figureheads in paleogenomics
mm-hmm.
and studying extinct species, having been the first person to sequence dodo bird DNA back at the turn of the millennium. Also, the first person to sequence passenger pigeon DNA, I should point out. She did mm-hmm. that in the same paper, but no one really made a big deal about that. Because the dodo is so much more famous and cool.
Sure.
So a number of other scientists were there, hosted at George's lab. And one key person that was there was Joel Greenberg, who is a historian of the passenger pigeon. And I had gotten to know Joel in a roundabout way during my graduate work when I was trying to do DNA sequencing on passenger pigeons. And he knew about my long, from our conversations, my long-standing passion to recreate extinct species for conservation. He reached out to me and said, I was just at this meeting with the Brands, and you know, they want to do what you want to do. You should get in touch with them. So, I mean, I couldn't find Stuart or Ryan's email online, but I could find George's. So I emailed George, and the very next day I didn't hear from George. I heard from Ryan and Stuart. He mm-hmm. forwarded my email to them, and it turned into a phone call, and that turned into a summer internship, which turned into a job position as the world's first full-time de-extinction biologist or ecologist, whatever you want to call me. I ended up quitting grad school and pursuing work. I'd actually already was quitting grad school for personal reasons, so it was an opportunity to seize. And you know, I really haven't looked back since, I guess, in that regard, because I've been extremely privileged to be shaping this field ever since. And the reason I go into detail about all of this is in that first phone call with Ryan and Stuart, you know, I explained to them my childhood passion for coming at this and how it came from the concept that this was the next logical step for conservation, that, you know, people had put back wolves in Yellowstone after having been gone for 70 years and, you know, put the bison and elk and bighorn sheep back in Theodore Roosevelt National Park. You know, that this is, conservationists have a long standing history of trying to put back extinct populations because it's a good blueprint for restoring degraded ecosystems. And I said, you know, I think the technologies we create in this project will be immediately available to endangered species along the way. So the goal was never just passenger pigeon. It was literally parallel. You know, emulating the moon race and the fact that we shoot for the moon and create technologies that can be used for so many other things along the way. And that was Ryan and Stuart's vision as well. And then, you know, so one thing leads to another. We start with passenger pigeon project. George then brings in his mammoth project under our umbrella to kind of kickstart things. And then we host our first major meeting with more scientists around the concept of de-extinction at National Geographic. Then we have TEDx De-Extinction, which made this entire concept public in 2013. And it was through TEDx De-Extinction that we actually managed to finally get an opportunity to begin realizing the entire vision. So it wasn't just about passenger pigeons or mammoths, but it was about endangered species as well. Because at TEDx De-Extinction, a young man named Seth Willey, a deputy director with the Fish and Wildlife Service at that point in time in the mountain prairie region for the service, he saw the woolly mammoth talk. And he got in touch with Ryan and said he had this out of the box idea that, you know, if we were talking about recreating mammoths, there had to be something we could do for the endangered black-footed ferret. And at the time, I knew very little about black-footed ferrets. And we got a crash course 101 in black-footed ferret history and threats by Seth. And it seemed like a really great initial species that needed help to develop. That needed help that biotechnology could offer. And we started shaping that program summer 2013. And, you know, 7.5 years later, 2020, we produced the world's first cloned black-footed ferret named Elizabeth Ann, who was cloned from cells that were frozen at the San Diego Zoo when I was 1 year old.
Awesome.
It's back in 1988. And there's a long history to that, and we're still moving work with that forward to come up with a solution to the disease that impacts them, plague from Asia. But along the way, starting with black-footed ferret, the black-footed ferret really has been, I think, our model program for expanding into more and more endangered species. So while we started with projects that were the majority de-extinction and this one endangered species, in our 9 years running now, we've become 95% endangered species and just a couple de-extinction projects. So we now have, you know, launching from the black-footed ferret model and how that was going, we managed to launch the Catalyst Science Fund, who are fund manager Bridget Baumgartner has managed to expand and diversify, bringing in her amazing abilities that she brings to our team. And we now have, through that, the Wild Genomes Program and the Advanced Coral Toolkit. The Advanced Coral Toolkit has 8 projects, funded projects, that are doing everything from trying to create coral stem cells for new regeneration techniques, to new biobanking and cryopreservation techniques, to understanding what makes some corals why are some corals doing really well right now in the climate crisis while others are not, and how we can, you know, harness that to help these ecosystems forward. And then the Wild Genomes Program is really about not developing new technologies, but using existing genomics to actually demonstrate that it has real impact and short-term value to conservation, because for a long time, and this somewhat relates to that hesitancy to use these, like even genomics, you know, genomics was seen as very expensive. Not a lot of people in conservation have the right backgrounds to understand how to use it. And the people who do understand how to use it, they're publishing conservation genomics papers, but not in journals that reach people who can use it. There's been a big gap between the science and the practice of these tools. And through our meetings, that's been something we've been really strongly trying to tie together and bridge that gap. And so the Wild Genomes Program is intentionally structured to have conservationists and genomicists together on teams so that the data is, one, produced in a way that is useful to the situation at hand, and two, we actually end up getting that transition, that handoff, that the information ends up getting used to have a real world impact. And I think that's really going to create waves in the community. And where this has all led us to in this long run is now the fact that we're demonstrating existing technologies, we're innovating new technologies. You know, I've just scratched the surface of some of the things that we're doing. Sure. And we've got these controversial shoot for the moon de-extinction projects. All this stuff has generated huge amounts of discussion about what could be the unintended consequences of meddling with nature and genomes. And so this has culminated in what is now known as our intended consequences movement, which Ryan Phelan got the chance to take center stage at TED this year and actually introduce what is unintended consequences. And it isn't meant to simply be a counter to the unintended consequences knee-jerk fears. It's meant to be a rebalancing, a very needed rebalancing of the considerations of how we act in conservation.
Sure.
And hopefully with everything, because I think, you know, as I said, the hesitancy towards biotech and conservation isn't just the fact that some of these technologies are very new and foreign to the people that could be using them, which automatically creates a concern. But it's also the fact that a lot of people, even who study conservation, believe that, you know, these things like biocontrols from the early 1900s that went horribly wrong, like the cane toad in Australia, that's the poster child, are evidence that messing with nature inevitably leads to unintended consequences that are disastrous. This is an extremely commonly held view. So much so that there was a Twitter feed for a while where a professor asked, are there conservation interventions that led to unintended consequences? And I think almost every single reply was an example of an intervention in nature that had nothing conservation. It was all biocontrols for agriculture or, you know, engineering environment for human means. Like, you know, like a lot of people think that the promotion of kudzu in North America was for conservation because you read in history, it says it was used for soil conservation. But in the early 1900s and mid 1900s, the concept of soil conservation or erosion control was not at all about nature. It was about keeping soils literally from washing away after people had built a road, you know, or a railroad, right? So they were planting plants where they had already destroyed everything and gone, oh, we don't want the dirt to wash away. We need to plant something here. And they're like, oh, well, rather than replant what was here, let's just use something that we think works really well. And they promoted kudzu like mad. Kudzu had literally nothing to do with helping the conservation of nature. And almost every biocontrol that's gone wrong in history or every intervention in history has that same theme. You know, that our paradigms have shifted as our consciousness has changed. You know, predator control in the early 1900s was not about nature. It was about protecting agricultural livestock interests. And so So there, you know, there's erupted this huge concern about unintended consequences, which is not founded in the history of conservation. Conservation has a long-standing history of doing really well because it has always tried to account for and predict what the unintended consequences could be and develop mitigation strategies and work around that. But I think the field has become so crippled and paralyzed now by that because it's not recognizing its own success enough. Yeah. It's not recognizing the models that have yielded success. And it's just kind of, you know, getting steeped in a growing culture of this fear. And now, because of that, the real risk is of debating unintended consequences endlessly is that you don't act.
Yeah.
And when you don't act, there are consequences.
Sure.
Literally unintended ones. So it's a self-fulfilling prophecy that if you sit at a table and debate what could the unintended consequences be, that while you're doing nothing, the unintended consequence of biodiversity loss happens.
Mm-hmm.
There have been a number of species that have gone extinct because people didn't act soon enough because they were at the debate table. And so the intended consequences movement is meant to be the solution, or I mean the resolution for that we balance caution with the need to act and you know, play on those very solid models from conservation history that built good programs and apply that to things like biotechnology and new innovation, because we need to innovate, we need to be able to use these tools. And the history of biomedicine and other fields actually show us that we can use these very effectively and iteratively. And so, you know, it's a hard and nebulous concept to try and get across, but Ryan did a really great job in her TED talk. So if you haven't seen that already, anybody listening, go and check out Ryan Phelan's TED talk on unintended consequences, and you'll see, you know, where we've kind of come full circle. That Stewart actually launched de-extinction with a TED talk back in 2013. It started with passenger pigeons and mammoths. It became about the ferrets, and now it's corals and everything around the world, from Takahe to albatross to brown sea cucumbers and sea turtles and whales and the Joshua tree.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and capping that off is this recognition and need that this is not just about science. It is about the socio-political and cultural movements that make conservation happen.
Yep.
And so I think, you know, that's a very, very long-winded way of expressing the role of Revive and Restore and what we're doing, that we're taking all angles and approach to promote the innovation and adoption of biotechnologies where they can be used responsibly and very effectively in nature. And we are the only nonprofit in the world that has that role right now. And we get to be nimble and take a lot of risk in that because we're a small office of about 6 people. And so in that startup mentality and mode, we get to, you know, really push the envelope. Where more established and larger organizations have to move a lot slower.
No, I appreciate that that extensive overview, and I think it and we'll definitely link to Ryan's TED talk on that front, because I think that's an extremely important message as part of the whole picture. You know, Ben, I would really be interested, you know, you have what you call at Revive and Restore the rescue toolkit. And I think it's very important, you know, for people. I was going through a lot of this, and for people to understand, you know, this is not your work doesn't end by, hey, you know, here's my dodo bird, here's my passenger pigeon. There's a lot more to it. And as you've outlined on the Revive and Restore website, you can create the passenger pigeon, but you need to breed it. You need to restore its habitat. You need to have policy in place so we don't hunt these things again like we did the first time around, and on and on. And then, you know, looking a little through the history of Ectopistes migratorius, went extinct in 1914. We hunted the hell out of it. We destroyed its habitat. It was a very social bird, so it made a lot of that stuff easy. Talk a little bit about, and whether you want to do it with the passenger pigeon or one of these other species, Przewalski's horse or the heath hen, walk through a little bit about what sort of the rescue toolkit approach is all about. And obviously, you can probably give hour-long lectures on these things, but walk us through a little bit about that, because I think that's underappreciated, and I guess most people think about it. This is not just some CRISPR and some stem cells, and voila, we have a million dodo birds. Take us on a little journey there, if you would.
Yeah, well, I'll be concise, and I think this is actually a great opening to another important topic that's very fresh right now for me. So the Genetic Rescue Toolkit, or sometimes we call it the 21st Century Genetic Rescue Toolkit, is on our website. We have it as a kind of this staircase-styled graphic, basically to show that there's a way of how these new biotechnologies kind of are additive on top of each other.
Mm-hmm.
And it all starts with genomics, the code of life. It all starts with studying DNA.
Mm-hmm.
And from that very first step in the staircase, there's a lot you can do. As I said, that's where our Wild Genomes program comes out of, is just using genomic information to improve the ability to make decisions about how to translocate wildlife or breed them in captivity. One of the more ambitious programs is actually using genomics to identify disease-resistant alleles in the sunflower sea star, which was devastated by sea star wasting disease about a decade ago. Over 95% of its population was wiped out. And the sad thing is, sea stars are a major component, and this to kelp forests. So kelp forests are literally the forests of the ocean. They support thousands of species. And the sea urchin is a pesky little devil that likes to eat the roots of kelp plants. And when it eats the roots of an entire kelp, that kelp then floats out to sea and dies. So of course, they play their part. They're an important part of an ecosystem, but you need sea urchin predators to prevent them from overpopulating and destroying the entire forest. And the major predators of sea urchins happen to be sea stars. Sea otters also play an important role as a mesopredator there, but sea stars are really the keystone predator for that ecosystem. And with the loss of sea stars from Washington all the way to Baja California, kelp forests have been utterly decimated. And the weird thing about sea urchins is they can apparently live without solid food for 50 years. So they can just hang out siphoning nutrients from the water until kelp start to grow back, and then just eat the kelp all over again. So we absolutely need to restore predators like sea stars in order to allow kelp forests to have a chance to bounce back. Well, how do we do that? I mean, you could put them back out there, but then if the disease comes through again, it's just going to wipe them all out again. So a team led by Michael Dawson at UC Merced is going to use genomics to identify which alleles allow resistance, and then strategically breed disease-resistant individuals in captivity that still maintain genetic diversity.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the thing, is you can breed for a trait.
Right.
You know, that's how we've created every domestic strain. But when you do for one trait, you end up carrying along some potentially bad traits, and you end up losing diversity at a lot of other parts. So by using whole genome information, they'll be able to spread one trait through a population and still retain the adaptive potential that has grown over the years in that species. And so that's a really cool example of how a team is planning on creating a disease-resistant population for restoration that will end up having a huge impact to restore an entire ecosystem, and all they're using is genome sequencing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you start thinking of adding on top of that things like of course, we kind of link genomic sequencing with biobanking. If you're getting tissue samples, you know, to do DNA sequencing, you should be putting something in the bank for later, which is how we created Elizabeth Ann. You know, someone actually froze her cell downs. Oliver Ryder's team did that back in the 80s. And we were able to do something incredible with those years later because they were biobanked, which is greatly underutilized. You know, people are taking samples from endangered species all the time, but because there's a lack of awareness of how to handle those samples to cryopreserve them, or where to send them to be cryopreserved, most of those samples are are not saved in a way that could be used later for restoration. So we're also promoting a huge, we're promoting biobanking hugely in our new toolkits coming out for 2022. And on top of that, you know, years later, if you have the right reproductive technology, like cloning for mammals or, or stem cell technologies, you know, you can then get back in that bank and create those organisms. And if you can create organisms from a cell that lives in a flask, you can also introduce new elements to its genome using genetic engineering or gene editing. Mm-hmm. And the one somewhat kind of offshoot also thing in here is if you understand genetics and you can do things in a petri dish, you can create bioproducts in a way that doesn't require harvesting organisms.
Yep.
So, you know, people thinking about cellular agriculture, right? People thinking, can I create cell culture leather so we don't have to kill animals for leather anymore? We are promoting hugely something called a recombinant factor C, which is a biomedical molecule derived from the horseshoe crab. Not a lot of people know that, you know, you've gotten your COVID vaccine, you've gotten your influenza vaccines, any drug or instrument placed in your body, if you have a hip replacement, whatever, anything that's gone in the human body has been tested for potential toxins from bacteria, which could kill us, using something called LAL, limulus, I can't remember what it is.
I remember this from years ago, but blue blood,
from the blood of horseshoe crabs. And every year people harvest tens of thousands of horseshoe crabs, and it's having a major impact on that species, leading some to say they need to be listed as endangered. And for 25 years now, there has been an alternative that was developed through biotechnology. Yep. Someone discovered the gene in the horseshoe crab that creates this a compound known as factor C, which makes the LAL test work. And they were able to splice that into a bacteria and grow back copious amounts of bacteria in a petri dish and then harvest that protein, just in very similar ways to how insulin is created these days for diabetics. And it's an amazing tool, but the pharmaceutical industry has not fully adopted it yet. Yeah. So, and there are, once again, that's mainly socio-political things behind that. It's not necessarily scientific. So we're definitely promoting that. And so, you know, it's there's a diversity of things you can do that once you understand a genome, you have the ability to work with things at a cellular level and then recreate organisms from that, that you can do a huge amount of things with that for conservation. And that is the genetic rescue toolkit. And in the world of birds, you know, thinking of once we get a passenger pigeon, what do we do? You know, the idea of breeding and restoration is actually, you know, pretty tried and true. You can look at programs like the California condor or peregrine falcons that, have bred birds in captivity and released them to the wild and discovered how to, you know, how to condition their behavior, how to raise them with puppets or with surrogates, and have had huge success restoring populations in nature. Actually, captive breeding and reintroductions have happened, I think, every continent around the world in now dozens upon dozens of nations, and to great effect. A lot of people think they have like some kind of problematic history, but they have a really great strong history that's been getting nothing but better. That carries in, and that's not actually the part of the passenger pigeon project that worries me. Some people say like, oh, well, you won't have parents, etc. And it's like, well, once again, people have already proven surrogacy and puppet raising to work incredibly well, even for complex social species. So I'm not so worried about that end being successful, but getting there for birds relies on being able to take that single cell in the petri dish and turn it into an embryo and get a surrogate mother to bring that baby to the world, lay an egg and hatch it. And with birds, you know, we cannot clone birds the way that we created Elizabeth Ann, the black-footed ferret. The way they lay an egg, their little reproductive biology is so different from how a placental mammal breeds,
sure,
that cloning doesn't, it's just not feasible. I'm not going to say impossible, because science can basically almost do anything, but it's so infeasible that it's just not even worth trying. And scientists recognized this a long time ago. So back in 2006, an avian biotechnologist named Marie Cécile Vandelavoir and her partner in crime at Crystal Biosciences, Robert Etches, they created a cell culture for something called a primordial germ cell. For decades, people had realized in birds that, you know, if you can't clone them, if you can't do in vitro fertilization with them, you know, there had to be a workaround. Mm-hmm. And so in vitro is actually a good way of thinking about this technology. So in vitro fertilization, we take donor sperm from a male, from a dad, and donor eggs from a mom. We create an embryo in a petri dish, and then we implant it into a surrogate mother. Now for humans, usually that is the donor mother, but it doesn't have to be. You can have a completely separate third mother to bring that baby to term. In birds, even if you take the sperm and the eggs from donor mom and dad, mm-hmm. you can't create the embryo in vitro. Right. You can't make it in a petri dish and get it to grow up from that point, which is the same reason why cloning can't work. You create the embryo in a petri dish, you have to get it to grow up. So what they've done is they've actually taken it one biological step back. Whereas rather than harvesting sperm from a donor dad and eggs from a donor mom, they harvest the stem cells mm-hmm. in the reproductive system that become sperm and eggs in adults. They harvest what those stem cells called primordial germ cells from a donor mom, a donor dad. And then rather than create an embryo in a petri dish, they just grow those stem cells up in a petri dish, so they have a lot of them, and then transfer those to a surrogate mom and a surrogate dad. So there's a surrogate dad in this equation, and then they create the embryo the natural way. They breed, and you get a baby from the donor parents through surrogate parents. And it is an incredibly effective technology in the domestic chicken, which it was developed for. And sadly, even though the mechanics of that system work for other species, the recipe for growing a chicken's primordial germ cells in a petri dish have failed to keep other primordial germ cells of any other species alive for more than a couple of weeks. So they can't actually grow them up and then take care of them and feasibly transplant them very well. So there hasn't been much need to move beyond the chicken for the last 16 years because the chicken is the major bird of agriculture.
Right.
But people started recognizing early on that this could have major promise for endangered species, much more so than the technologies we have for mammals. So, you know, you could imagine, say you have a rare type of parrot.
Okay.
And you were able to take the donor primordial germ cells from multiple mothers and multiple fathers, like an entire flock of birds. Mm-hmm. And you implant 20 donor cell lines into one female chicken and 20 donor male lines into one male chicken. Mm-hmm. And you have one breeding pair of chickens that then breed and produce the same genetic diversity of offspring as an entire flock of endangered parrots.
Okay.
Not only are you producing a lot of diverse offspring from a single pair of birds, which changes the resources needed for captive breeding, but also those rare parrots will only breed seasonally. They'll only produce one or two eggs at a time. So in an entire flock of rare parrots, you might get 20 to 30 offspring max. Whereas from that single pair of chickens in a year, you could get maybe 300 offspring. And so you could rapidly recover a species and have larger numbers to restore to the wild. And larger numbers has been shown to be larger numbers and genetic diversity have been kind of the underpinnings of what makes successful reintroductions, which can be difficult to do with seasonal and low clutch birds. So, I mean, there's some cool things you could do just by being able to grow those cells and transfer them to a surrogate. Even if you can't put them in a domestic chicken, just being able to grow those cells and put them into the surrogate of the same species would allow us to finally freeze things away for decades and bring back diversity if those species get in trouble the same way we've done as the ferret. But as I said, this is something that has not been translated beyond the chicken. So just 2 weeks ago, I hosted a workshop that brought together members from all of the world's best biotechnology labs and birds from Korea, Japan, Australia, the United States, Britain, Germany, and France, and had them get together with conservationists from around the world working with bird species. And we started talking about how would we translate these technologies and work together to make them work for other bird species. And, you know, hopefully every bird on the planet, right? And there were some really great breakthroughs shared at that workshop. And out of it came the formation of an international collaborative consortium, which we will now be fundraising for, that has some very targeted actions towards biobanking and developing these cellular and reproductive techniques in birds so that we can bring the full genetic rescue toolkit to the world's birds. And not only is that going to enable things like recreating the passenger pigeon, but it's going to enable just a huge amount of things for endangered birds around the world, which is incredibly needed. One out of every 8 birds in the world is endangered today. That's only going to get worse with climate change. A recent report from Audubon showed that if climate change is not slowed or staved off, that in the next 60 years, 389 bird species in the U.S. will become endangered. That's nearly 5 times more than are endangered today. And we have literally no way of preserving their genetics and recovering it later. Right now, we know we can put fibroblast lines in the bank, etc., but we don't have a technology to use those. We know that PGC, primordial germ cells, will work, but we have no way to really put them in the bank very well. So there's just so many links in the chain that we have to forge here. And we now have a team of people that have the right expertise from poultry genetics and other things, working with the right people who know what's going on with endangered species. And we are growing that team out right now that we can forge all these links and complete this picture. So I'm really excited about that. Because I'm a bird person at heart, and you know, so if I were to say anything to viewers, I would say, you know, that is our next big fundraising push. It will be the biggest fundraising push we've ever done. So if you love birds and biodiversity and birds, please donate to Revive and Restore and help us make this happen, because we now have a truly stellar team to launch this forward, but we need to fundraise for it now.
Absolutely. And we will help you get the message out. Ben, at the beginning, you know, when you were going through sort of the history of the organization, you know, you brought up the Mammoth Project, George Church. And I had George on a show about, it was about 2 years ago now. He wasn't talking about mammoths at the time, but since then, you know, obviously a couple of months ago, he announced the launch of this new company called Colossal. I also spent some time with Dana Rashid of the Chicken Dinosaur Research up in Montana. When it gets into this realm of, I don't know if this falls in the area of true de-extinction per se, but more sort of synthetic organisms and new things, although you're going to try to create something that once existed, but you're going sort of the reverse engineering path. Just give us some top line on this in general. Obviously, I'm specifically to the mammoth concept, but anything. I mean, I always talk to my kids before I did these episodes, and they, you know, you mentioned your kids really into dinosaurs. Mine are crazy about the megalodons. And, you know, if someone showed up tomorrow and gave you $10 billion and said, you know, I'll fund you for however long, but I want you to make a megalodon for me, take, you know, great white shark and whatever you need to do, would you do it? Is that Is it interesting to you, or is that something you say, no, the synthetic stuff is, it's neat, but it's not for us?
On a few notes, if someone came up to my door and said, I'll give you all the money you need to recreate Megalodon, I would first say, I would say no on the first hand that Megalodon is not a species that has a place in the world anymore. So it went extinct about 2.5 million years ago. Humans had nothing to do with their extinction. And I think if people are worried about the unintended consequences about mammoths and passenger pigeons, they may be very concerned about a 50-foot-long shark,
sure,
being brought back into the world. But sadly, you know, even if my answer wanted to be yes, the science gives us a really hard no, okay, on most extinct species. Right now, with what de-extinction is, we need to actually have access to the genomic code of our extinct species. Yeah. DNA does not last forever. Yeah. It degrades very rapidly. And even under the most ideal conditions, it may only last 1.5 million or so years. Like, even if you had it in a cryopreservation freezer, it's eventually going to break down. And that is why most of the great DNA you hear about is coming from permafrost in Siberia, where, okay, it's been frozen for thousands of years. The oldest permafrost layers on the planet are less than 2 million years old. So there is no viable DNA in the world that is realistically achievable beyond about maybe 1.8 million years, either through a predictive model or just the fact that we don't have permafrost older than that. We get DNA out of things like tropical caves and seawater caves and things because those are very stable environments. But even then, we're talking thousands to tens of thousands of years, not millions of years. So when we think of de-extinction, currently we're thinking of ice age to now. And not just the last ice age, but basically Pleistocene to now. Which is fortunate because actually most species that have been driven to extinction in the last 125,000 years have been driven to extinction because of changes made to their environment by humans, either through direct harvest of those species in combination with changes to the environment or from introduced species and other changes humans have made in the environment. Most species that have gone extinct in the past, in the past 100,000 years also were kind of cut short. We know from the paleontological record, and I come from a paleo background, that most species duration before they either go extinct or evolve into something else is between 3 and 5 million years. Most species that have gone extinct since the Pleistocene were not at the end of their 3 to 5 million year run. They are species that were very much in their prime. And it's key to remember that every plant and animal and organism alive today has a coevolutionary history with everything that was alive in the Pleistocene. Everything alive today was alive back then too.
Yeah.
It's not like things went extinct in the Pleistocene at the end of the Ice Age and then we had the evolution of a whole bunch of new life.
Got it.
In fact, we have not had the evolution of any new life. So you consider slight tweaks in certainly some populations of insects and other things to be new evolution. There has been some. But we have not had new large speciation events in the last 10,000 years. We are a Pleistocene world now living without most of our Pleistocene fauna, which is a shame because people keep saying we're at the dawn of the sixth mass extinction. It's like, nope, we're in the middle of it. It started 100,000 years ago. We have lost immense amounts of life. And when we consider the mammoth, it's a really good example of all of this in the fact that at the 10,000 years ago, there were at least 17 species of proboscideans living on almost every continent except Australia and Antarctica. We had gomphotheres in South America, mastodon, Colombian mammoths, pygmy mammoths, and woolly mammoths in North America. We had dwarf elephants on islands from Indonesia all the way to the Mediterranean. We had long-tusked elephants in Europe, woolly mammoths in Eurasia. African elephants, forest elephants, Asian elephants. There was a lot of diversity of proboscideans. Fast forward to today, we have three. So we've lost nearly 90% of the diversity in a single family of organisms. And now from genomics, from many of those extinct species, we know that interbreeding between different species was a huge key to their evolutionary success, that you had one form develop and then exchange its traits with another, and that kept them adaptable for a very long time. So now that we only have three species that are very geographically isolated with populations that are now isolated, gene flow cut off, that entire family of organisms has lost its ability to evolve the way it used to. And so by reviving genes from mammoths, we do a few things there. One is create a population of proboscideans in a much safer environment. You know, it's not like poachers are going to Siberia to kill animals. Siberia is very, very inhospitable to humans. The human beings that live there are probably more like woolly mammoths than people at this point. Very rugged and tough people up there. Mm-hmm. And also, we enrich the entire family with some diversity that could end up helping it persist and last long term. So there's a lot of both evolutionary and ecological reasons, as well as political reasons, to create mammoths. Mm-hmm. And as how George Church and Colossal are going about it. So as I said, George Church brought his mammoth project to revive and restore under our umbrella for many years, and it incubated there.
Yep.
And George Church has a history of successfully launching biotech companies. And so a young venture capitalist, Ben Lamb, you know, he brought the for-profit mentality that could bring in the money to get that project going. Because quite frankly, the philanthropy model for years was not bringing in donors for that. People think that we've got tons of money for de-extinction and we have almost nothing for it. It's been a struggle to engage donors and the public at large with the fact that these projects are worth putting money into. And well, stop. What is that? There we go. I don't know what I just did to my phone. So it's been difficult from a philanthropic standpoint to get money for de-extinction despite the many benefits that could come from it. But Ben Lamb was able to bring in investors that saw the promise of those peripheral technologies, right? This is a moon race. It's not just about mammoths. Right. There's things that come along the way. And while I am sad that the mammoth is no longer a nonprofit model, because I personally don't feel there should ever be ownership over anything in nature, I am very happy that they have the money they need to make that project a success. They're going to be able to go about doing it beyond the limitations that low budgets do. So actually, what probably some people will be unaware of for a while is the fact that with more money, the Mammoth Project is actually going to be less synthetic than it would have been on a low budget.
Okay. Interesting.
And be closer to authentic mammoth than ever before. And there's reasons behind that, but I'm not going to get into them, but I would just say that if we get similar adequate funding for passenger pigeons, all of this will be less synthetic. And when I say less synthetic, I simply mean the ability to do more and more editing to get closer to the original genome of those species. Because none of this is synthetic. It's DNA.
Right.
DNA is life. We've been able to harness being able to build code, you know, to do gene editing, but it's all life at the same time. And that was the point of my 2018 de-extinction paper, was to lay out what this field really is right now. And it's the ability to basically hybridize using a dead parent from an extinct species, just using genetic information, and a living parent species. And if we do that selective breeding in the petri dish the right way, then we get an animal that ends up looking like one parent rather than both, the way most hybrids do. So, it, you know, no matter what, the new mammoth and the new passenger pigeons will be new entities, new hybrid-like entities mm-hmm. that have a different evolutionary lineage from the original, but they will carry the actual genetic legacy of those originals. And I think that's at the heart of de-extinction right now, and why something like a megalodon cannot be created, because we don't have its genetic legacy. That said, there may be a future in which we understand enough about genomes to be able to actually mix and match traits and synthesize genes completely, artificially, mm-hmm, to mm-hmm. create the traits we desire and create complete copies of extinct organisms that we have no DNA from, things like dinosaurs or megalodon or whatnot. But those will be complete fabrications. Yeah. And I hope the world never really bothers with it, simply because we don't have a place in nature for those. We don't have a place for them to benefit the world right now. And, you know, that gets us to that weird Jurassic Park model, right?
Right.
It's a great movie, fun book, but a person created dinosaurs to live on an amusement park. And that's one, not exactly the greatest thing for the dinosaurs in that situation. And if they ever escape the island, which they have now in the movie franchise, then of course it's not good for anywhere else. So that's why we
unintended
are
concerned consequences.
Exactly. That's why we are concerned with driving the intended consequences of conservation using species that have a very clear benefit and co-evolutionary place with the species that are struggling today, yeah. like the passenger pigeon. So, yeah. you know, it's, I don't want to take up all of your viewers' time with all of that, but if anyone wants to know what the natural history of the passenger pigeon was, then, you know, get on YouTube and look up Passenger Pigeons, A Force for Forest Disturbance. It's a webinar I gave a few weeks ago to the forest food, mainly to forestry managers, and explains basically in a nutshell 9 years of our research on passenger pigeons, and which has been has grown with consilience with independent researchers about the role that passenger pigeons played in nature, a bit about their history, and the reason why that role is incredibly beneficial and important and vital for today's eastern forests in North America. And what's really great about that webinar as well is it has an introduction talk from Dr. Ian Thompson of the Choctaw Nation. It's very rare to get indigenous knowledge of any kind about this species. So it was an incredible privilege to get to follow up his talk and get to hear his talk. And the Q&A answer question, Dr. Thompson added just immense amounts of perspective to that, that everyone should listen to. So even if you just skip over me and listen to Q&A and him, it's worth it just in that. But I hope the 90-minute video is not too long for people interested to check out anyway.
And we'll definitely link to it in the bio, because it is an important resource. But really extremely fascinating set of programs you have there, and really wishing the best with all of this, because it is truly needed, especially in 2021 and beyond, and where we've gotten. And everybody that's going to be listening to this particular episode across our podcast networks or watching on the YouTube channel, you've been listening to Ben Novak, senior scientist, lead scientist, Revive and Restore. Check out their website, which we will have in the bio. Also check out Ben's article, 2018 review article, De-Extinction, the journal Genes. Also check out Building Ethical De-Extinction Programs, Considerations of Animal Welfare and Genetic Rescue, published in December 2019, the Routledge Handbook of Animal Ethics. Ben, I want to thank you for taking the time out of your schedule to talk to us for a little while about what you're up to. Thanks for everything you're doing. And as we say on our show, thanks for helping to create a better tomorrow, not just for all of us, but for all of these species. Really fascinating program.
Thank you for having me.
It was a great time. Really great time.